This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Geht es Ihnen nicht auch auf die Nerven, wenn ein Unternehmen mit all seinen Auszeichnungen prahlt? Uns auch. Fühlt sich so aufgesetzt an, oder? Mit uns von Kapital.com können Sie sich also wieder Ihrem Podcast widmen. Übrigens haben wir bei den 2024 Online Money Awards die Auszeichnung Best Overall Trading Plattform erhalten. Oh, ups. Kapital.com. Viel besser in Sachen Trading als in Sachen Werbung. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm James Kamarasamy. It is the 1st of February, the day when Donald Trump takes what he calls the most beautiful word in the dictionary, tariffs, and turns it into action. You might call it T-Day. The White House has said that from today, the Trump administration is placing tariffs or extra import duties of 25% on all imports from Mexico and Canada, while Chinese goods entering the United States will face a tax of 10%, a triple whammy for America's three biggest trading partners. President Trump has also warned he'll impose tariffs on goods from the European Union. Speaking to reporters on Friday, Mr. Trump said there was no room for last-minute negotiations to avoid the new tariffs. He said they were in response to the flow of the illegal drug fentanyl, which he claimed some countries were allowing to enter the United States.
It's a pure economic. We have big deficits with, as you know, with all three of them. And in one case, they're sending massive amounts of fentanyl, killing hundreds of thousands of people a year with the fentanyl. And in the other two cases, they're making it possible for this poison to get in, number one. And number two, we have big deficits, and it's something we're doing. And we'll possibly very substantially increase it.
Well, Mr. Trump indicated that Canadian oil exports to the United States would actually face a lower tariff imposed later on this month. Speaking to the BBC, a leading contender to become Canada's next Prime Minister, Mark Carney, condemned the move.
The steps that the president is taking are going to rebound negatively on the United States. They're going to hit growth. They're going to move up inflation. They're going to raise interest rates. They're going to damage the U.S.'s reputation around the world. I mean, let's be absolutely clear. This is the second time in less than 10 years, less than 8 years, that the United States has, in effect, ripped up a trade agreement with its closest trading partner that it negotiated in good faith.
Meanwhile, on the streets of Mexico City, people say they're worried about the effects of the new import duties on their livelihoods.
As a small business owner, it's bad because the cost of everything will go up. And in the end, I think it's the devaluation of money for Latin American economies. It affects us all.
I think it's going to affect us a lot. I mean, I, for example, make a living from selling cakes on the street, and I think I'm really going to be affected by this.
Entrepreneurial anxieties in Mexico. Well, China's foreign ministry has warned Donald Trump that a trade war has no winners, even though the new 10% tariff on Chinese goods is a far cry from the 60% that Mr. Trump had threatened on the campaign trail. But with China's annual exports to the United States currently worth around $500 billion, Beijing is still bracing itself for these extra import duties. Bracing, but also preparing. Over the past year, thousands of Chinese businesses have moved their production abroad, as our China correspondent Laura Bicker reports.
This is the sound of an all-American cowboy boot taking shape. They were once crafted to conquer the Wild West, but these carefully stitched designs are now made in China.
When things get busy, the whole factory gets packed with people, shoulder to shoulder. But these days, there are fewer staff at each process.
Mr. Peng has worked at the factory since he was 15, but more than 20 years on, he's worried about dwindling orders. US buyers don't want to risk more of Donald Trump's tariffs on Chinese-made goods.
In the end, it is the workers at the bottom who suffer. With higher tariffs, we have higher costs. With higher costs, we have fewer orders. The workers' income will decrease.
This leather boots factory can make
when it's busy. 70,000 pairs of handcrafted leather boots in a month. But right now I'm looking at lots and lots of empty tables. They're actually having to make French military boots to try to keep the factory going.
Each shoe is hand-polished at the end of 100 different processes. The owners have thought about moving production to Southeast Asia, but they would lose their skilled workforce.
As you can see, the workers here are like family to each other. If we were to move, they'd lose their jobs and end up unemployed. Therefore, our boss chooses not to give up on them.
Other Chinese companies, however, are on the move. Parts of Cambodia have given itself to Beijing. Half the country's investment now flows from China.
You can tell me a bit about the factory. So what are we seeing here?
The factory has only been running for a few months, so I only have these workers here for now. Once we are fully staffed, there will be 1,500 workers. All of our products are for export, 100%.
Huang Zhaodong makes clothes for US firms like Walmart and Costco, and he's getting ready for more orders. His factory and his workers are in Cambodia, but most of the materials still come from China.
A lot of our customers, especially American clients, have asked us to make their products overseas. They suggested that if I produce their orders overseas, it will be less risky.
Successes like this one increase China's influence across Southeast Asia.
Here on the streets of Phnom Penh, the flashing neon signs are not just in Khmer. They are mostly in Chinese, offering everything from duck noodles to milk tea.
Trump's tariffs have not stopped China's rise. Beijing has simply gone elsewhere to do business. China may lose some money in this battle, but it's still gaining power and influence.
That was Laura Bicker reporting, and the view of Chinese businesses there. But how is the Chinese government preparing for the new era of Trump tariffs? Dr. Keyu Jin is a Chinese economist originally from Beijing, who's currently an associate professor at the London School of Economics. She's also the author of The New China Playbook. So how does she think Beijing is likely to react to these new tariffs?
Beijing has long been preparing for the return of Trump and the return of tariffs. So, in fact, 10% is better than 60%. I think that China's focus on the internal economy means that it will be very loath to really engage in a trade war. It's very different from the last time around where the Chinese economy was in a stronger position. This time, their most likely reaction is really to come out with a full package, full stimulus package domestically to offset some of the tariffs.
Is China better prepared, despite the economy being in a weaker position than it was last time round, to offset effects of tariffs?
It was forced to be better prepared because ever since the first tariff war, Chinese companies have been really going crazy over globalization, small and medium-sized companies all having international plans and investing in Vietnam, Mexico, and actually moving part of their supply chain. So ever since, a few years ago, there has been absolutely nothing but diversification, de-risking from U.S. engagement.
Nonetheless, China exports far more to America than it imports. So even 10% presumably will have an impact on an economy which is not in a particularly healthy state at the moment.
Absolutely. I think it's going to cause damage really to both economies, unlike the first time around, because the U.S. is actually very vulnerable to more inflation. And just as U.S. interest rates set the global financial conditions, Chinese manufacturing prices actually set global prices. So whether you trade with China indirectly or directly, you are affected by the tariffs on Chinese goods.
And in terms of the diversification of markets, is that going to continue? Is that going to gather pace, do you think, if America keeps tariffs on Chinese goods?
China has seamlessly reallocated its exports to the U.S. into other economies. And China's share of global exports has risen, while U.S.'s share has declined since the first trade war. So exports have been quite robust. That's not really the problem here. I think China's biggest challenge is real estate, weak domestic demand, rather than on the export side.
As you mentioned, the 10% that Donald Trump's talking about at the moment is considerably lower than the 60% he was talking about on the campaign trail. What message do you think Beijing will take away from that?
That he is open for negotiation, that Trump is someone with whom China can work and hopefully stabilize the U.S.-China relations. They might interpret as actually Trump's focus this time is not just on China, but actually will want to strive to be the person that seems to have cooled down the U.S.-China tensions.
Yes, of course, he invited President Xi to his inauguration. A senior Chinese government official was there in the room. So the signals are interesting, aren't they, in terms of the broader relationship between the two countries?
To be honest, China just wants to have a normal relationship with the U.S., not trying to get anything out of the U.S., trying to accommodate to the extent it can to stabilize the relationship. China doesn't have this dangerous obsession with the U.S. in the way that Washington, D.C. is obsessed with Beijing. Its eyes are on its own internal issues, the real estate and the economy. And frankly, I think that given China's current position and its trajectory, it's not really that keen to be highly engaged geopolitically and internationally. However, that said, U.S. stepping away, abdicating some of its global roles in climate change and so forth, I think China is going to try to step up.
And do you think there's something that American companies should be worried about? Clearly, there are plenty of American companies that have big interests in China. I mean, not least somebody like Elon Musk, who's very close to Donald Trump. What do you think might this new reality of tariffs and transaction might mean for them?
First of all, China is open for business. And just as the Trump administration has threatened with tariffs and putting America first, the Chinese leadership has come out with the opposite program of a unilateral tariff reductions, even zero tariffs on the least developing countries. It's trying to send a signal. China's open arms to foreign investment, to investing in other countries and to trade. So in that sense, China welcomes American investors, American financial institutions to the extent that they want to be in China. And that is more of an opportunity rather than a hindrance.
Yes, I was going to say, is this then an opportunity for China, both showing itself to be more welcoming to outside trade, but also taking a leading role in the green transition, the green economy, if America is moving back from that and going back to fossil fuels?
Absolutely. You can feel that the temperature is slightly warmer towards China in the West, in Europe, and elsewhere. Why? Because countries are getting more practical. Economies except the U.S. are not doing well, and trade with the U.S. is going to be more and more unreliable. So they are having a much more positive attitude towards China than a few years ago. And China will see that an opportunity, including with Europe.
And that was Dr. Keyu Jin, a Chinese economist who's originally from Beijing, currently at the London School of Economics, with her view on how the authorities in China view these new tariffs being imposed by the Trump administration. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. And coming up later on in the programme, we'll hear why physicists at a university in central England are trying to protect a blackboard signed by Albert Einstein. And the headlines at this hour. Hamas has released three Israeli hostages in return for 183 Palestinian prisoners in the latest stage of the Gaza ceasefire deal. The president of Burundi has warned of a wider war if Rwanda continues what he called its conquests in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. We'll be hearing from the DRC a bit later on in the programme. And Chinese tourists have been flocking to the home village of the creator of DeepSeek, the chatbot that's shaken American dominance of artificial intelligence. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamarasamy. There have been more scenes of joy in the Middle East today after three Israeli hostages were freed by Hamas and 183 Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails were also released under the terms of the current ceasefire agreement. The three freed hostages were Yaden Bibas, Ofer Calderon and Keith Siegel. He's a US Israeli citizen. Well, Daniel Lifshitz is a friend of Keith Siegel. He's also a relative of Abel Yehud, who was one of the hostages released on Thursday, and he's the grandson of Oded Lifshitz, who is still being held in Gaza. And Daniel spoke to the BBC about the latest releases in Hostages Square in Tel Aviv. That's a place where friends and relatives of the hostages have been gathering.
It's unbelievable. The energy here is crazy. You can see all the people. From the square of tears and pain, it became the square of joy and happiness. And you see the faces. You see the look on each one's face here, how calm and happy they are, how the tears go out. It's unbelievable.
Well, let's speak to the BBC's Yolan Nell, who's in Jerusalem. Yolan, let's start with the hostages who've been released. What do we know about their condition?
Well, Jamie, I'm in Hostages Square in Tel Aviv as well. I mean, nothing has been officially said about the physical condition of the hostages. Ofer Calderon's mother, when she caught the first sight of him as he appeared with these masked gunmen in Khan Yunus, said that he appeared okay. And then we saw footage of his happy reunion with his four children, two of whom had also been taken captive with him on the 7th of October. Then, within the past hour, Keith Siegel arrived by Israeli military helicopter here in Tel Aviv. We heard the helicopter overhead, and he appeared to need help as he walked slowly to the Red Cross vehicles when he was being handed over in Gaza City's port. Pictures with Israeli soldiers that were subsequently seen by his wife. You know, she was saying in footage that was also released that he seemed to be okay. Yaden Bibas has been reunited with his parents. He's 35 years old, appeared physically well, but, you know, psychologically, his situation looks very difficult. We've got no news of his wife, Shiri, and his two young boys, who are the youngest hostages taken, raising fears they didn't survive.
And tell us about the process of the release, because there's been a huge amount of criticism, hasn't there, from Israel and beyond about the chaotic scenes that we have seen in previous hostage releases.
Yeah, in particular what we saw on Thursday. But today looked a lot more orderly. And mediators had actually asked for guarantees that would be the case to protect the hostages after, you know, there were seven hostages released by Islamic Jihad in Khan Yunus on Thursday. And really, you know, that crush looked extremely dangerous. And it led to Israel temporarily holding back the Palestinian prisoner release that happened in exchange that day. There is another aspect here, of course, which is that Hamas has really been seeking to show force to re-establish its control in Gaza despite the heavy losses that it has gone through in the war. And, of course, that is something, as a takeaway as well from the latest proceedings, that will worry Israel.
Let's hear from the other side now, Yolanda. These are some of the scenes in the occupied West Bank in Ramallah when those Palestinian prisoners were freed. So what can you tell us about the Palestinian prisoners who've been released today?
Yeah, so what the Red Cross has told us is it picked up prisoners and detainees from two locations, from this big detention centre in southern Israel, also from a prison in the occupied West Bank. Dozens were serving life or long sentences, but the majority of them were from Gaza and people who had been held without trial or charge in very controversial circumstances that have been condemned by human rights groups. We have in the past hour or so seen shots of some of those in buses wearing their grey tracksuits, talking to journalists out of the windows of those buses, complaining about their harsh treatment.
Yoland, many thanks. That was the BBC's Yoland Nell there speaking to us live from Hostages Square in Tel Aviv. Well, these latest hostage and prisoner releases come on the same day that the first medical evacuation since last May have been taking place through the Rafah crossing in southern Gaza. The World Health Organization has been overseeing the transfer of several dozen seriously ill people. although the WHO says that is a fraction of the thousands of people inside Gaza who need to have emergency medical help outside the territory. Dr. Rick Papercorn is the WHO representative for the West Bank and Gaza. And earlier today, we managed to get through to him at the Rafah crossing.
To date, WHO and PSCS and partners, we are currently managing and supporting the first medevac since the ceasefire process started. That is 37 patients and 44 companions. It's a slow process. The ambulances are going one by one, first with the non-walking patients, as I said, and then the walking patients and the companions will be checked and then moved on to the Egyptian side.
Is it an orderly process?
It is an orderly process. It is for us a slow process. It's way too slow if we think about what we have to plan for in the coming months. But it's at least a good day. It's the first time there is a medevac happening through Rafah crossing since it closed on 6th of May 2024.
And today, what are the numbers like? How many are getting out today?
So the numbers for this first medevac through the Rafah crossing are low, are 37 patients and 44 companions. So it's the first day. It needs to speed up, and that's maybe I would like to stress that. So estimation, 12 to 14,000 critical patients need to get out of Gaza for the treatment they cannot get in Gaza, they need and deserve. Half of those patients are roughly, we estimate, are related to war and trauma injuries, amputees, burns, spinal injuries, which will need multiple operations and specialized rehab. The other half is the more chronic diseases, a lot of oncology, cardiovascular diseases, etc. Approximately 5,000 of them we expect to be children.
How are the decisions being made then in these early days, or the very first day, of who the priority patients are?
So the Ministry of Health, medical specialists of respective hospitals, they are making up the priority list, the selection of the patients and link to the patients as well, the companions. So just want to make that very clear. WHO, we are not involved in the prioritization and the selections, the numbers of patients, including companions.
Are the Israelis involved in any way in the security aspect of this? Presumably they will have concerns about who is coming out.
I think all those patients and their companions, they are screened. They're security screened by both, in this case, the Israeli authorities and the Egyptian authorities.
There is a screening process which, again, presumably will slow down the evacuations.
Yeah, we don't hope so, but that's what we have seen in the past. And we should not only have a medical corridor into Egypt through Rafah, we need to have also the medical corridor to be restored from Gaza to East Jerusalem and the West Bank.
That was Dr. Rick Papercorn. He is the World Health Organization's representative for the West Bank and Gaza. He was speaking to me there from the Rafah crossing in the south of the Gaza Strip, which is where those first medical evacuations since last May have been taking place. Just remind you, if you miss any live editions of our programme, you can always catch up with the podcast. We update it twice a day, 7 days a week. Just look for BBC NewsHour podcasts in your search engine. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamarasamy. Welcome back to NewsHour. And the latest sign of how the Trump administration is shaking up the geopolitical framework, the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, is calling for a new beginning in relations with the United States. It follows the release on Friday of six American citizens who were detained in Venezuela. The American government, which regards Venezuela as a hostile state, failed to recognize Nicolas Maduro's claim of victory in last year's election there. So what's going on? Joining us now, Christopher Sabatini, senior fellow at the Chatham House think tank here in London, a specialist on Latin America. So, Christopher, what kind of deal do we think might have been struck here?
Quite frankly, we don't know. It was clear before Richard Grenell traveled to Venezuela, the assistant special envoy for Latin America in the State Department said that there would be no quid pro quo. In other words, there would be no trade-off for any of the concessions that Maduro made. And there were two things the United States wanted. They wanted the return of the American hostages. There are 9 total, 6 were released, as you said. But they also want to have Venezuela accept the deportees from the United States. There are at least 600,000 that came under temporary protected status that has now been revoked. There's probably twice that in the United States also illegally. And they need to have the concession of the Venezuelan government, Maduro government, to accept them. So those are two things. But we don't know what they got in exchange and what the Maduro got in exchange. This is a tough government that really does, take negotiations very hard. And there had to be some form of concessions from the United States. We just don't know what they are
yet. Rick Grenell, who you mentioned, President Trump's special envoy, close to the leader. The interesting thing, of course, here is that the Secretary of State, the new Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has taken a very tough line against Venezuela, a sort of traditional line as well. So it is interesting to see what is going on here.
Yeah, there's a real deep division. Some would even say an interim administration spat right now between Rick Grenell, who favors negotiations, who's close with a number of businesses that want to do business and want to see the sanctions fully lifted on Venezuela, including oil companies. And you have Marco Rubio, who staked his sort of, if you will, his entire reputation as being hard on communist dictators in the Americas. He's Cuban-American. First with Cuba and then also with Venezuela. He's very close with the opposition. And it was funny because just before the trip to Venezuela, Rick Grenell tweeted out pictures of him with Trump and him with Vice President J.D. Vance, sending a signal to the world, but also to Marco Rubio, that he's closer to Trump than Marco Rubio is.
Briefly,
so we'll see.
Yeah, but I mean, briefly, Christopher, could there be a reset of some sort with Venezuela?
One actually hopes. The truth is the hardline policy of the sanctions haven't worked. Democratic conditions have continued to deteriorate. There are more than 1,000 political prisoners in Venezuela. Something has to be done. The question is will Marco Rubio tolerate any concessions to a regime that he considers illegitimate?
Christopher, many thanks. Christopher Sabatini, Senior Fellow at the Chatham House International Affairs think tank here in London there on those interesting developments in the relationship between the United States and Venezuela. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamara-Sami. Let's head now to East Africa, where the march of the M23 rebels in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo continues. After the rebels captured the city of Goma, the capital of the North Kivu province, they are now heading south towards the capital of South Kivu, Bukavu. Hundreds of casualties have been left in the wake of the rebel advance in the last few hours. The health ministry in the Democratic Republic of Congo has said that 773 bodies have been identified in morgues in and around Goma. Well, the rebels are backed by Rwanda, and in a few minutes we'll hear from the Rwandan foreign minister. First, though, let's hear from Bukavu, which appears to be the rebels' next major target. Therese Mema Mapenzi is the director of the Center Olame Bukavu. It's a Roman Catholic faith organisation which works with women and children. So what's she hearing about the M23 rebels' progress towards her city?
Since yesterday and the day before yesterday, we heard that the M23 are fighting in the mountains of Kalehe. And Kalehe is more or less at 80 to 100 kilometers from Bukavu, where I am based. And since we knew that they took Goma, people here in Bukavu are really afraid that they may take at any time Bukavu, but also afraid of the fighting that can happen in Bukavu, because in South Kivu, we have so many armed groups, and some may be on the side of the National Army or in the side of the M23. So we are afraid of this situation.
So what are civilians doing? Are people leaving Bukavu?
Those who are in Bukavu are moving to Bujumbura, to Kigali, and others, they go far to cross the border in Tanzania.
So they are moving some to Rwanda, some to Tanzania, some to Burundi. They are leaving the DRC.
Yes, they are leaving the DRC. For those who have means And those who do not have means, they have to stay. The fear is if the M23 reach Bukavu, it means that the fighting will be high comparing to what happened to Goma. It is really complicated, and this is the fear of the community.
What are you seeing when it comes to the presence of the Congolese army, the DRC army in Bukavu at the moment? Are they a visible presence in the streets?
Since the morning, we saw some cars going and coming back. We don't know where they are going, but it shows the sign of war, the sign of fear, the sign of insecurity in the city. And also the shops are closed. The bank are not working well. The markets, they are opening, but people are afraid of any kind of looting. The market is now very, very expensive. So the vulnerable people, they don't have possibility to get food. And all this impacts on the humanitarian situation in Bukavu.
You talk about vulnerable people. You work with women and girls. There have, of course, also been reports of sexual violence being used in this conflict. Is that something that the women and the girls that you are helping are worried about?
Yes, of course. At any time where there are these army conflicts, the women are really the first victims, also the children. Some may be raped, others may be taken in hostage, others may be forced to prepare for the rebel groups. So this is, again, the fear that many women, including myself, have because of this fighting. And this is why sometimes I ask the world, what do they do for these conflicts? It has been many years since we talk about the conflict in DRC. We have the UN mission in here in DRC. It's a shame to see that they stay in DRC since more than 30 years, but they have never found any solution to this problem.
Are you going to stay there, Therese, if the M23 approach Bukavu?
Myself and my family, we don't know where to go. Because if I go to Rwanda, which is in somehow our enemy, I don't know if I'm safe there. And as we work for the civil society, sometimes we speak out to denounce what is going on. So we know that we are subject of any insecurity issue, but we don't know where to go.
That was Therese Mema Mapenzi speaking to me from Bukavu. She spoke there about Rwanda being their enemy, and there has long been bad blood between the Democratic Republic of Congo and its neighbour, Rwanda, following the genocide of the Rwandan Tutsis in 1994. Many of the Hutu perpetrators escaped across the border into the DRC, where they reconstituted as the FDLR militia. While the M23 Tutsi-dominated rebel group, which has been accused of widespread human rights abuses, including the shelling of civilians in this latest outbreak of violence. And this is not the first time they've gone on the offensive against the Congolese army and state, and not the first time Rwanda has been accused of backing and fighting alongside them. So, why is Rwanda doing this? A question my NewsHour colleague Julian Marshall put to Rwanda's Foreign Minister, Olivier Ndungyong-Girehe.
Rwanda is defending its territory. Rwanda is under threat by a coalition in Eastern DRC organized by President Tshisekedi, and that includes the FDLR genocidal force that committed genocide in Rwanda against the Tutsi in 1994, but also other forces like the local militias, Wazalendo, and the Burundian forces, the Sami DRC, which are from the SADC region, but also the European mercenaries. So we have this whole coalition that was deployed, but it was deployed in a context of regime change rhetoric, which is really regular and constant by President Tshisekedi, because he said on several occasions that he wants to overthrow the government of Rwanda and bomb Kigali without even setting foot on the ground.
So how many Rwandan troops are there in the DRC?
I told you that we have defensive measures at our border.
Right, but even defensive measures require the deployment of troops. And I was wondering how many Rwandan troops you have in the DRC.
You know that every defensive measure has troops, has other means to defend our territory. This is what we have deployed for the past 2 years to ensure that our people is protected.
So these Rwandan troops, you argue, remain on the border and have not taken part in any of these incursions by the M23 deeper into the DRC.
But the M23 is a Congolese movement defending a Congolese community that is persecuted, that was marginalized, discriminated against, and then victim of a hate speech. This is what the M23 is fighting for.
Fighting for what?
To defend their population, their community that is marginalized for decades. The international community is keeping silent, and not even silent, just accusing Rwanda instead of looking at the situation that is going on in Eastern DRC, which is genocide ideology, ethnic cleansing against community, the Congolese Tutsi.
And the Rwandan government supports the M23 in this particular campaign.
We have a common goal for sure, because when we are facing a genocidal movement, that should be an enemy of anyone.
So just to explain, this particular dispute goes all the way back to the genocide in Rwanda and the flight of Hutus who were held responsible for that genocide into the DRC. And you are saying that those Hutus, the Hutu militias, are now terrorizing the Tutsi population of eastern Congo, and they need to be protected.
This is not what I said. This is what happened. I just gave you a specific example.
I mean, you ascribe these very noble aims to the M23, and yet a UN report in December last year said that the M23's decision, for instance, to capture the mining town of Rubaya, which fell to its forces in May, was motivated by a strategic need to monopolize the lucrative trade in coltan used to make batteries for electric vehicles and mobile phones. So there's a commercial imperative here, and I would argue that that commercial imperative is shared by Rwanda.
That is the narrative that we know from Kinshasa, which was endorsed by part of the international
community. I've just quoted a UN report, not a claim by the Kinshasa government.
Exactly. I say that it's a narrative from Kinshasa that was endorsed by part of the international community. The fact that there are minerals on their land, that is another matter. It's not their objective. As a matter of fact, Rwanda has also minerals, as we know. We are on the same rock as the DRC, because I don't believe that minerals can magically stop on our colonial borders.
Okay, but Rwanda exports more minerals than it produces, which leaves open the question of where those additional minerals are coming from. And many say that's from the eastern Congo.
We have plenty of minerals. And second, Rwanda is a stable country with a good climate for business. So the fact that some of the traders go through Rwanda because it's where they can do business, it doesn't mean that it's about plundering Congolese minerals.
Rwanda's Foreign Minister Olivier Nduhungirehe, he's speaking to NewsHour's Julian Marshall. Well, let's get the quick thoughts on that from Timothy Longman, Professor of International Relations at Boston University. He's been following events in Rwanda and the DRC for 30 years. Welcome to the programme, Timothy. What do you make, first of all, of that claim from the Foreign Minister that the Hutu rebel group in the eastern DRC poses a threat to ethnic Tutsis in the Democratic Republic of Congo and to Rwanda itself?
Yeah, the FDLR, the rebel group, is just, it's not much of a group anymore. It's become very small. It's diminished. It's true that there's a lot of Congolese who hate the Tutsi because Rwanda keeps invading and they associate the Tutsi with Rwanda. But it's kind of a mafia bargain. They're creating the threat that they're promising to protect people from. So there's no evidence that there's any kind of genocide against the Tutsi in Congo that would justify this kind of large-scale attack on the civilian population of the country.
And what also of the claim from the foreign minister that Rwanda is not motivated by commercial gain, that it doesn't rely on the mines in the DRC because it has the same minerals as Rwanda, the Congolese?
Yeah. Rwanda does not have coltan. Rwanda has trace amounts of gold and small amounts of tin. It's a mineral-poor country, and there's a lot of minerals that flow from Congo into Rwanda. There's a neighborhood in Kigali called Merci Congo, Thank You Congo, that was built by money that was plundered out of Congo, and that's continuing today.
And finally, also that accusation that the Congolese president, Mr. Tshisekedi, has been spreading hate speech against the Tutsis.
Well, he certainly hates Rwanda, and they do blame Tutsis for a number of the problems because M23 has caused great humanitarian suffering in the region. There's almost a million people who've been displaced by the fighting, and they're taking more and more territory. They're killing people, and they're driving things. It's true that there's evidence that Tshisekedi may be supporting the FDLR in some ways as well, but it's a small force, and Tutsi are not being slaughtered. It's the people who are not Tutsi in Congo right now who are dying.
Timothy Longman, Professor of International Relations at Boston University, thanks very much for joining us. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, coming to you live from London. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamarasamy. The fashion world in Paris has been paying tribute to the British milliner or hat maker Stephen Jones, after collaborating with some of the world's best-known designers, from John Galliano to Jean-Paul Gaultier for the past 40 years, he now has a retrospective of his work at the French capital's main fashion museum. And Stephen Jones has been reflecting on four decades in the hat business with our correspondent in Paris, Hugh Schofield.
Yes, I was a punk, and I first came to London to go to college in 1976, so that was really the year of punk, and London and Britain was unrecognisable to the 17-year, 18-year-olds of today. Certainly there was punk, and then there was the vacuum that was created by punk. And we thought we had to create our own world, that the world that was out there did not exist for us almost. We had to do our own thing.
Is there something in the making of hats as opposed to dresses which is different in the world of fashion? Well, I'll just throw that out. What is different?
What is different? Very, very different. With clothing, you're draping fabric around the body normally, or you're tailoring it, whereas with hats, you're actually making a construction which sits on top of the body. So for somebody who was always making models of Spitfires and making space rockets out of cardboard boxes and things when I was a young boy, hat making was sort of a logical step.
Is there another aspect of this, which is that the hat kind of frames the face? The face is the mirror of the personality. No two faces are alike. Bodies can be alike. Therefore, each hat and each face has to have a particular match.
Well, it has to have a particular match, and a mismatch as well, because even though the hat is the frame for the face, people know how they look and quite frequently want to look like something else. So you have the reality and you have the fantasy, and that's what I do. I play between the two things. I fell into hat making really by chance. I was at fashion school, at St. Martin's School of Art as it was then, and I really could not sew. I'd been to a boys' boarding school. So my tailoring tutor took pity on me, and I became a tailoring intern in his couture house. But next to the tailoring workroom was a millinery workroom, and I asked for a transfer, and it was just a bit of a eureka moment. But I have to say, it was the people who were milliners who I really admired and loved, and they seemed to work hard and play hard, so that was really the place for me. Even as an 18-year-old, I thought I didn't want to be in this very competitive environment. You know, I wanted to go to the party.
So it was less competitive to be a milliner?
It was less competitive. Milliners are quite sort of easygoing in a way. Tailors are very competitive.
Would your tailor friends mind you saying that?
No, because I think they probably agree with me.
Chapeau to him indeed. Stephen Jones speaking to Hugh Schofield there in Paris. Physicists at the University of Nottingham in central England are trying to protect a rare artefact that has been hanging rather anonymously on a wall. It is a blackboard signed by Albert Einstein. So, what's the story behind it and what's the need to protect it for future generations? Dr. Emma Chapman is a cosmologist in the physics department at the University of Nottingham.
So, just under 100 years ago, the University of Nottingham invited Albert Einstein
to come and tell everybody in the physics department all about his new theories of general relativity, which are the idea of how space-time works, how the universe works. He was friends with one of the heads of department here. And so on the evening, he was due to give a lecture. He did turn up late, which is very Einstein. He ended up getting distracted by Isaac Newton's house in Lincolnshire on the way. But he did turn up. And what he did was he spoke in German about all of these theories, all of these mathematical equations. And as he was doing so, we had one of the physicists actually translating from German to English. And also he was transcribing the mathematical equations on the blackboard.
A blackboard which Einstein then signed.
Yes, that's correct. So it's one of very few blackboards in existence and the only signed one that we know of at all. There's one more in the UK at the University of Oxford. There were two, but somebody unfortunately cleaned one of them. So this is a very, very rare item and it's got a wonderful signature and a date right at the bottom of it. You can look at it and you can see all of the text. You can identify the equations that describe a black hole. You can see his signature. So it's not beyond repair by a long way. But what we do need is somebody to come in and just tell us what we need to do.
And no chance of it being cleaned because it is preserved, isn't it?
Thankfully, yes. We've had the common sense here at Nottingham to put it behind glass so that nobody could make that mistake. But it's definitely in need of some TLC. It's not at the kind of state-of-the-art conservation levels that we need it to be, that it deserves to be at.
So how concerned are you at the moment that the glass isn't good enough?
I mean, honestly, I'm quite concerned. And it's not just the glass. It's that it's fixed to a wall in a fairly crude manner of a very little used meeting room here at the physics department. And we're currently having lots of construction work done. And so every time one of the drills goes off, I'm having kittens thinking, oh my Lord, chalk particles could be floating off this thing. So I think, you know, anybody from a museum would just come in and sob if they actually saw the state that we have it in at the minute. We've tried really hard, but you know what? As physicists, this is not our expertise.
No, well, maybe the construction bit could be. But what about what you're planning to do now? You've clearly identified the problem. What are you hoping the solution will be?
Well, we're hoping to conserve it, to recover any damage done, but also at the same time bring it out so that the public and the students, most importantly, can actually see this piece of heritage, because at the minute, as I said, it's in a very little used corner of the physics department. You can honestly go through your entire degree at Nottingham not know it's there at all. So the idea is to bring this piece of history out into the public domain, but we need money to do that. I'm only 2 years in, 3 years in actually, at the University of Nottingham, and I spent the first 2 years not knowing it was there, and I still to this day don't understand how that's happened. We even have the piece of chalk that he wrote on the blackboard with. I think it's just a case of we're so used to having it there, it's kind of like a shrug and a, oh, do you want to go see Einstein's blackboard on open days? And people go up there and they go, what? All generations are absolutely floored by this object. But the state of higher education as it is, we simply don't have the money to preserve a blackboard, however important it is. And it's lovely to see the building blocks of theories that we still haven't got a hold on today.
And that was Dr. Emma Chapman, a cosmologist who works in the physics department at the University of Nottingham, on that blackboard with the workings and the signature of Albert Einstein on it, and their hopes of preserving it for posterity. That is all, though, for this edition of NewsHour from me, James Kamara-Sami, and the rest of the team here in London. Thanks very much for listening.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.